With the novel The Color Purple, Alice Walker became the first black woman novelist ever to be honored with the Pulitzer Prize. The book and its movie adaptation made Alice Walker a household name. It also made her a controversial figure in the minds of many of her male readers, who criticized her for portraying men as cruel abusers of women. Alice Walker is also a poet, essayist, feminist, and civil rights and peace activist. Born and raised in rural Georgia, she now lives in Northern California. Two of the characters in The Color Purple, Miss Shug and Miss Seeley, make appearances as elderly women in Walker's new novel, The Temple of My Familiar. One of the main characters is Miss Seeley's granddaughter. The novel continues Walker's use of fiction to explore racial and sexual issues. Alice Walker grew up in rural Georgia. Her parents were tenant farmers. I asked her if she had access to books when she was growing up.
Well, people gave us books. We didn't have very many. You know, the schools didn't have books. But for my birthday, I always got books. I got Gulliver's Travels, and my father once found some old Shakespeare plays that someone had thrown out. And, you know, my sister had books that people had given to her, and she would read them to us. And by hook or by crook, we sort of, you know, we knew good books.
Did your parents know how to read?
Yes, they did. But they didn't generally read the books, you know, that I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. My mother finished fourth grade and my father finished fifth grade. But they had a love of books. And, you know, I mean, it was really very moving, because the books that they couldn't read, you know, the difficult ones like Shakespeare, for instance, they would just sort of sit and rub the covers, you know, with a real longing to know, you know, what was in them.
Did you get a sense from your parents when you were very young what life they expected you to lead when you grew up and became a woman?
Well, always to be honest, you know, to be truthful, to be fair. That was what they expected.
And where did they expect you would live, and what did they think you would do as an adult?
Well, I think probably their highest dream was that I would be a teacher. But more than anything, they wanted me to be a good person,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether I taught or wrote or whatever, you know.
I think people who know you from The Color Purple might have assumed that there was some history of abuse in your family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to ask you about that so that mm-hmm. you can set the record straight one way or another.
Well, you know, I think the primary thing in The Color Purple that is from my family actually happened to my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was murdered.
She was?
Oh, yes, and this is in The Color Purple. Harpo's mother, you know, is murdered by her lover. And that is the story of my grandmother, Kate, who was actually shot down outside of the church when my father was 11. And this, you know, this act of sexism, because the man shot her because she refused to be his mistress, even though she was a married woman, she had children. And what happened was that, you know, because she was a woman, she was blamed for her own murder, you know, and for attracting him. And this was felt, you know, all the years later, and in my own life. I mean, this happened when my father was 11, but it was still very much a part of who he was, even as, you know, an adult with his own children, many, many years later. And in some ways, it was the dirty little secret, the strange little secret of my family. You know, why had this beautiful woman, my grandmother, been killed? And why was she blamed for her own murder, when in fact she was innocent? And sexism was at the heart of it, because really she was blamed just because she was beautiful, just because he wanted her, and just because she said no.
Is that how the story was presented to you? Is that what the moral was when you heard the story from your family?
What?
Or did they see it differently?
Well, they said that it was, you know, they always phrased it in a way that made me feel that it was her fault.
Uh-huh.
And it just rankled, you know, in the way that, you know, you go for years, you think, well, there's something about this tale that is not quite right.
You also wrote in one of your essays that, I think you said that men always seem to become more sensitive as they got older.
Mm-hmm.
And when you knew your grandfather as an older man, he seemed, this is, I think, a different grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Both my grandfathers had that quality, though. They were both extremely sexist men
mm-hmm.
in their young incarnations, you know, with my grandmothers. I mean, terrible, terrible people, very violent, you know, very, just totally sexist, some of the worst sexist behavior you can imagine.
Abuse? Physical abuse?
Oh, yes, physical abuse, you know, wife battering, child battering. But by the time I came along and, you know, some of my older siblings, they had mellowed out really wonderfully. And this was also quite amazing to me and quite intriguing. How is it that these old, beautiful gentlemen who truly love me, you know, how could they have been so awful to the women who they married? So all of those things went into writing The Color Purple, you know, trying to understand how people can be so vicious and so sexist and so cruel and so awful, and then over the years come to see that that's not the way to be,
mm-hmm.
and come to be people who cherish, you know, children and who love women and who support women. And so
was your father abusive?
Well, my father was very mean to one of my sisters, and I think it was because she reminded him of his mother, the one who was murdered, and he tried you know, to prevent the same fate for her, even in a very sort of twisted way, because he didn't really understand, by being very strict. And so they were always in conflict, mm-hmm. and he was sometimes physically abusive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it took me really years and years to understand that he probably never understood why he behaved that way. I mean, because all of his life he'd been taught that his mother was murdered and it was his mother's fault that she was. And he had loved her.
Novelist Alice Walker is my guest. Her new novel is called The Temple of My Familiar. I want to ask you about an incident that I think had an incredible effect on your life. When you were young, I think you were playing cowboys and Indians or something with your brothers. One of the brothers accidentally shot a BB that hit your eye and blinded you in that eye. How were you changed as a child by that?
Well, I was really, you know, I think I've noticed this in the lives of writers and artists, that often there is an illness or something that sets them apart at a young age, like 8 or 9, and they suddenly, you know, feel separate, and they then are able to look at reality in a totally different way. I mean, they begin to notice how things evolve, you know, they begin to record, you know. And I think that happened to me. I think that when I had the injury, I found myself suddenly removed from, you know, sort of everyday life. And I first began to really then look at it and, in a sense, appreciate it. I place a lot of value on seeing, you know, and trying to see clearly what is actually there.
It didn't prevent you from reading, I guess.
Well, no. For a while it did, because, you know, there was a lot of pain involved. But no, not at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always read a lot.
You got a handicapped scholarship to Spelman College in Atlanta because of your eye.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written that your neighbors raised the bus fare to you for you to get to Atlanta. Were you the most intelligent girl in the community at the time? And
well, I was valedictorian of my class, and I was also most popular and voted queen of my class. Oh. So they had no choice but to give me $75 and send me off.
I guess you'd stop being the outsider by then, huh?
Well, you know, there's a way in which you always are. Because you know Flannery O'Connor talks about the habit of art, and part of it is just that ability to always register what is going on around you without merging into it. And I think that, you know, for a long time anyway, that was the way that I was. I mean, I rarely merged. I was always sort of the one standing and watching.
Mm-hmm. You've written that you saw Spelman College as opposed to change, freedom, and understanding. And Spelman was a very prestigious college for young women.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you see it as being opposed to change and freedom?
Well, it was really just that it was very middle class, you know, and it had very sort of middle class and upper class aspirations, and, you know, white gloves and straight stocking seams, and, you know, freshly pressed hair. And all those things were very hard for me. I mean, I had come, you know, from a very poor working class family, and had a lot of rough edges and a lot of dreams that really didn't have much to do with whether my seams were straight and my hair was straight, you know. But I loved it. I mean, what I like to stress is that I found a lot of things wrong with it, and, you know, it didn't really fit me that much. But I had a profound love for Spelman, which I still have.
Well, you transferred from Spelman to Sarah Lawrence, and I'd imagine that there would be the same emphasis on, if not on white gloves, on some equivalent on that, and of being very middle class or even upper class.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely wrong, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true that the people were upper middle class and, you know, upper class, but the emphasis was really on art and what you did. I mean, it was, you know, people who came there saying they were writers, they actually wrote, and the painters painted, and the dancers danced, and the musicians made music. And they didn't care how they looked. You know, I mean, it was just the sloppiest place you could imagine, in a way. I mean, the people looked rather, you know, bedraggled. And it was great.
More of a bohemian lifestyle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because, I couldn't afford, really, I didn't have a coat, actually, when I went. So I couldn't afford, you know, to dress really well. So it was a great relief to not have to bother about dressing at all, really. I could wear my nightgown down to eat, you know, with something thrown over me.
Did going to college in the North and liking it there separate you from your parents in a way who remained in the rural South?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it was just beyond anything they could even imagine. They never saw the place. And it was as if I had just sort of moved off the edge of the world.
Did you ever want to go back to the rural South to live after going north or after living in the city?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I really love the South, and I love rural places, especially. And I would go back and visit my parents.
In 1964, you were pregnant. You were a young woman, not married. And you desperately wanted an abortion, couldn't find somebody to perform it. It was still, as we all know, illegal then. And, you know, you later wrote that you considered suicide. What were your fantasies of what your life would become if you had the baby that led you to suicide?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't have had a life. I mean, there was absolutely no way to... Well, there was hardly any way to support myself, and there was really no way to support myself and another, you know, person. So I don't, you know, I never got really beyond just understanding that it was quite impossible.
How did you manage to get a safe abortion?
Oh, friends found someone and took me to him, and it worked out very well. I was, of course, very scared, but it was better to have the abortion than to go to term with the pregnancy.
This experience actually led to your first book of poems, didn't it?
Well, sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just this feeling of being finally given my life back, you know, after thinking that I had lost it. And this was a wonderful spur to creativity. I was so happy.
Yet a lot of the poems in that first book are about ending your life.
Well, yeah, because, you know, the artist is always recording.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the good, the bad, the whatever. So.
Well, I'd like to talk with you more about your life and about your writing, but first we have to take a short break. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Alice Walker is my guest. This is Fresh Air. Poet, essayist, and novelist Alice Walker is my guest. Her books include The Color Purple and her new novel, The Temple of My Familiar. In the 1960s, you became active in the civil rights movement, and you were married then to a white lawyer. And I was wondering if being in a mixed marriage like that marginalized you in both black and white circles, or if people were accepting of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was. I mean, we were pretty much alone a lot of the time, and It was okay because we both were such hard workers, but I think it was very difficult for the black community to really feel comfortable with us. And of course, the white community was, generally speaking, hostile. So it was difficult, but at the same time, we managed to do a lot of, you know, good things. I wrote many books, and my former husband pursued many lawsuits and won a lot of them.
You've written that you've learned a lot about color having a mixed-race child. What are some of the things you feel you've learned about race in America from having a daughter who's born of a black mother and a white father?
Well, I used to think I had learned that it was easier, you know, for children of mixed parentage. But I think my daughter has disabused me of that notion. She has just told me that I'm wrong. So now I think, you know, it's just really hard for children, and it's very hard. I think, especially in mixed race families where the society is so divided along racial lines, it's difficult for the child to sometimes feel, you know, a kind of wholeness, a sort of mother and father wholeness around her, because one side is, you know, sort of going one way and the other side is going another. But I'm not sure that's not true in other, you know, families.
Mm-hmm. Because your writing is so woman-identified, I think some readers might assume that you've rejected relationships with men, which is certainly not true. Even in your most personal life, you've been in a long-term relationship with a man who I think still edits Black Scholar.
He doesn't. He now is one of the directors of the Oakland Men's Project, an anti-violence group in Oakland.
You've been together a long time, but I believe you're still not married.
What do you mean?
I don't mean still not married. So, well, next week.
I beg your pardon.
I didn't mean still. That you've decided to have a long-term relationship without getting married.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted to know your reasons for that. If you think that marriage can have negative effects on a relationship.
Well, we've been together now for about 11 years and really haven't felt the need for marriage.
Have you seen marriages backfire, you know, relationships change because of the legal contract?
I think one of the things I learned in my marriage, you know, was that the society forces you to be married. I mean, it really, no matter how you try to remain separate, the society makes you merge. And an illustration of that is how when I was married, I had for a little short while my husband's name, and I knew I couldn't stand it. I mean, I just will never understand how people can take on somebody else's name when you just don't know anything about it in a way. And I kept saying, well, you know, I don't want his name, and nobody listened to me. They called me by his last name. So finally I went to court, and I had the judge legally change my married name back to my original name. And I still had difficulty with people, you know, just insisting on calling me by his name. And I found this very insulting.
Mm-hmm. So by not having that contract, there's no assumptions that can be made about
exactly.
you losing part of your identity
exactly.
because of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're one of this country's leading feminists. Do you think that the issues are or have been any different for white feminists and black feminists?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I don't know if I can think of any, you know, off the top of my head, but I think just because, you know, black people, all of us are oppressed to some degree by the dominant white, you know, power structure, I think that's one difference. That's the only one I can think of right now.
Do you think that the feminist movement has alienated a lot of black women?
Well, I have no idea, you know. It hasn't alienated me.
Right. You prefer to use the word womanist to feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain why?
Well, womanist is, first of all, I really, for myself personally, just cannot stand words that require that you say I'm a black, whatever it is. You know, mm-hmm. you're either the thing or you're not. Mm-hmm. And as a poet, it just rankles that you have to always say, well, you know, I'm a black feminist or I'm a black, you know, this or that. And you notice that white feminists don't say that. I mean, you know, it's they assume that they are the original thing. But really, I wanted a word that just expressed more of my own cultural and traditional reality. Feminist is not, doesn't have the, you know, it just doesn't have that African American or African Amerindian sound to me. Whereas womanist does, because it's just so much more direct and it just sort of talks about the whole woman, you know. I also like it because in our culture there's an expression that mothers use when they're talking to their upstart, courageous, outrageous, bodacious daughters, which is, you're acting womanish. And it's very complimentary, although they may be chastising you at the same time. They are saying that, you know, to be a woman is to be daring, is to act as if you're grown, even if you're not. And so I wanted to use a word, you know, that incorporated that feeling.
You dedicate your new novel, The Temple of My Familiar, to your long-term companion, and the dedication reads, "To Robert, in whom the goddess shines." What is your concept of the goddess?
Oh, well, we could go on and on, but you know, the goddess, well, there are two goddesses who come to mind instantly. One is the goddess, the earth itself, is the goddess who is the reason we are here, you know. And the second is the goddess who is our common mother, who 500,000 years or more ago started the human race somewhere in Africa. But then also there is the goddess of love and the goddess of truth and justice and equality and love of women and you know, nurturing. And if you put all of those goddesses together into one, then you have the goddess who shines within my partner.
I know that, well, I assume anyways that the Christian Church was a strong influence on you growing up in the rural South.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that in thinking about the image of the goddess that you've rejected the church?
I haven't rejected the church, but I have come to an understanding that we each can have our own connection directly, you know, with the universe and with the spirit, and that the church is not really necessary for that. Now, the church may well be necessary for many social activities and political ones, because in our community, the church has been the only place, you know, sacred enough to function politically and protectively in the community. But we are connected. It is our innate ability to connect directly with the universe. And I do feel that sometimes the church is an obstruction.
More than one novelist on this program, and I'm thinking here of black men who write novels, have said that they feel now that books by blacks seem to be much more marketable if they're by a woman. And I'm sure you've heard this.
Well, not if there's nothing in the book.
Right. Well, I'd like you to respond to that criticism. I'm sure people have said that to you directly, and I'm sure you've read that criticism, mm-hmm. you know, from men. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, we work awfully hard, and we actually try to share everything that we discover in ourselves and in the universe. And we try to do it in such a way that we connect with people. I think that we speak from our hearts, and that we really understand how late in the day it is for, you know, humankind and for the planet, and that we really care. And I really think that is what people feel. And I don't think it's just about, you know, going into a store and saying, well, these books whatever they are by black women, and therefore we'll buy them. I mean, people buy what they need, and I think they need what we write.
Some readers of The Color Purple criticized you for, because of the portrayals of men who were often abusive in it, for dividing black men and women instead of unifying them together. Is that criticism a meaningful one to you? And what do you think of the criticisms that you've gotten for being divisive?
Well, I think for everybody that I've divided, I have brought some together. And I feel very good about that. I think I wish very much that people read with more comprehension and with more generosity, so that they could read The Color Purple and see that, you know, okay, these people were not such great guys on page 10, but by page, you know, 150, they're growing and they're coming along and they're really nice people. Nobody talks about Mister's relationship with Seeley when she teaches him to make pants and he brings her seashells. And that's very sad to me, because it means to me that my critics can only see the bad parts about themselves. They can't affirm the good.
Will you be writing another novel soon, or is this the time for a long breather?
I think my you know, I'm going back to California, and I'm going to get my garden started, and that's about all I intend to think about for a while.
Okay. Well, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alice Walker has been my guest. Her new novel, The Temple of My Familiar, is published by Harcourt, Brace & Jovanovich. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.